We are live.
Okay.
So just wanted to, well, thanks for having taking some time to have a chat with me today. And wanted to talk a little bit about hemodynamics and, of course, a little bit about renal focus and how you've been applying it and some of the recent stuff that's come up. So I'm going to hop right into the hemodynamics. And here's my question. I had this read this one article that I put up on the notes of the last couple of blog posts about the resuscitation tracks I did with Iceman X and EM Nerd. And there was this paper that they reviewed the optimal MAP targets in sepsis, and it was Jean-Louis Vincent's group. So obviously a fairly well-heeled crew. And they have this one graph that they put up, which is looks essentially like your basic autoregulation curve, right? And whether it's the brain or kidneys or whatever, that sort of upslope, flat, upslope again. And then they theorize that in sepsis, what you had is a line that you sort of have this autoregulation loss, and then basically that the relationship becomes more straight linear. And on the graph, they do say that this is a theoretical relationship. But that's radically different than the, say, physiological understanding and clinical perspective that I'd had on the relationship between MAP, that is manipulated with vasopressors in sepsis, and tissue perfusion. I don't know if you've got a model you like or you have in your head, or what do you think, Phil, so when you're thinking about the relationship between your MAP and your tissue perfusion?
Well, yeah, I think that it's probably a little bit different for everybody, you know, where their baseline is, and, you know, maybe where that autoregulation, you know, maybe at any one given time when you're healthy, it might shift, you know, to some different dynamic depending on, you know, what's going on. You know, sepsis is, you know, there's a lot of stuff going on. So,
sure.
And yeah, it's funny that you bring that up because I think I was reading something last week where they were talking about in sepsis that sort of autoregulation in each different organ is changed. So, you know, and it doesn't necessarily change, like, you know, say the gut may kind of clamp down and the kidneys may open up or something like that, you know, there's kind of a lot of local effects of the perfusion, you know. You know, to answer your question about, you know, I guess the how I would approach a patient that looks shocked is, you know, I try and see, you know, I use POCUS. POCUS is like, you know,
of course,
something that's changed the whole game, because
of course,
you know what their hemodynamic problem is, you know, if it's the SVR, if it's the cardiac output, if it's or the filling of the pipes, you know, and you know, you have to also remember that we have two pumps. We have a right ventricle and a left ventricle. And the lungs, you know, will get wet if the left ventricle gets backed up, so we can, you know, see the B lines, you know, developing, and we can actually have an idea of what left atrial pressures are if we have some, you know, echo skills.
Mm-hmm.
The right ventricle doesn't like pressure loads. We can, you know, see if, you know, how it's functioning. And of course, when the right ventricle starts backing up, it's, you know, associated with things like, you know, portal hypertension and you know, decreased renal perfusion. So, you know, if you look at just say, you know, since, you know, talking about the kidney, you're talking about just macro hemodynamics on that kidney, your aortic pressure, you know, you subtract the renal venous back pressure, which is pretty much a reflection of what your CVP is, and divide it by the renal vascular resistance, and there's your renal plasma flow, you know. But it's more complicated than that because, you know, the what's happening at the glomerulus and what's driving your GFR depends on, you know, what the tone is of your afferent and efferent,
right,
you know, vessels and all that. And so, and you know, that's what kind of, I guess, what we're getting at with looking at the renal resistive index is that we're hoping it kind of is telling us something about what renal vascular resistance is and how the microcirculation and how healthy the flow is in there.
Mm-hmm.
There are some things that, you know, you can do to sort of manipulate the renal resistive index.
Right.
And, you know, what I think is pretty clear is that the higher your renal resistive index is, the worse your kidneys are going to be. And your kidneys, you know, sort of seem to me like they're these, you know, kind of the canaries in the the mine, where they're kind of easy to hurt. And I used to think that, you know, they're tough guys and, you know, you can just slam them with fluids and all this stuff, but they're kind of little sissies and they don't like to be, you know, messed with when we do a lot of stuff, or, you know, try not to do it anymore, but in the past, you know, just like battered them with fluids. And I don't think that's the right thing to do. I think just, you know, you got to remember that when you do that, you're causing, you know, renal edema. They're in these little capsules. The perfusion pressure is going to go down for them. And just, you know, having a lot of fluid in Bowman's capsule is going to back up on your glomerulus. And you know, there's just a lot of things to think about when you're doing that. And people that get kidney injuries that are critically ill, they die, you know?
Yeah. I find it so, frustrating that, you know, unfortunately the vast majority of physicians involved in acute care still have a monosynaptic and aggressive reflex to just throw, you know, bucket after bucket of some kind of fluid or other, usually even NS to make it worse, at, you know, any sign of renal injury. You know, like it's a panacea for any kind of renal injury. It's never considered
that maybe the fluids is what got you to the renal injury in the first place.
Of course.
Yeah.
So, well, actually, here, if you're looking at the kidney, so one of the way I'd always perceived the relationship between blood pressure and tissue perfusion in the system, in a sick patient, that we're manipulating that blood pressure with vasopressors, was, you know, a slope that essentially sort of an inverted U, you know, where as you crank up the pressors, you end up getting over vasoconstricted and you get, you know, worsened tissue perfusion despite a better or equal blood pressure. That's, to me, the clinical way I'd seen it. And it makes a fair bit of mechanical sense, if you wish. I've seen that in patients where they're, you know, they're blue and purple, and particularly seen it in those cases where, you know, I've inherited someone with a radial art line that we're titrating a blood pressure to, swap it over to femoral, and all of a sudden, the blood pressure is actually 130. We can back down on the fluid, and then, you know, the modeling kind of goes away or improves. Clearly, the tissue perfusion got better with a drop in. Vasoconstriction, despite the fact that the actual blood pressure wasn't like something outrageous. It was, you know, essentially normal, you know?
Yeah. And, you know, I think what that is your resistance, or, you know, in any vascular bed is actually going to be, inversely proportional to flow, you know?
Exactly. Exactly.
Yeah. And so, you know, an example is, you know, a few months ago, I had this young kid who, for some reason, went into VFib and was resuscitated in the field and had a 20-minute, you know, trip in without any epinephrine, nothing. But he came in with a MAP of 90, and he looked awful. He was cold, he was diaphoretic, and he was, you know, just looked shocky. And I looked at his cardiac output, and it was 2. And his SVR was, you know, more than 3,000. I don't remember what it was, but, you know, you do the math, it works out to what his math was. And I put him on some dobutamine. It doubled his cardiac output and just about half his SVR. And he just dried up, turned pink, looked great. And, he had the exact same math. It was still 90. I think that it's not what the blood pressure is, it's where you're getting your blood pressure from.
Exactly, exactly.
So, you know, and you do have to, I mean, it's more than just, you know, throwing an ultrasound, looking what the hemodynamics are and stuff. You actually do have to put your hands on the patient, and be at the bedside.
Absolutely. Because I think that's one thing, like, you know, what we measure, like, you know, we've got the tissue, the tissue bed is distal to the resistor. And what we're measuring is the pressure that's proximal to the resistor. So in a sense,
right.
there's a bit of a, like actually Shagan said, there's a bit of an uncoupling between those two because the relationship isn't always linear. And like you did in your patient there, if the reason your blood pressure, you know, stays there is because you've doubled your cardiac output or you're given fluids which will increase your cardiac output, but if you've gotten that blood pressure via increasing the resistor, well, what you're getting at the tail end of those resistors has got to be less. It's just, I mean, seems
right.
like basic flow physics, you know?
Yes, yep, that's right, yeah. And, you know, again, we can't measure what's going on inside the tissues themselves for the most part. But one thing that's nice about the kidney is I think you kind of can with the renal resistant index in some cases.
That's what I was thinking, yeah. You might be able to look at that, the renal resistant index and its changes, because you'd mentioned already that a few times you've done some things which you can, you know, explain a little bit to some of your septic patients and then seen that renal resistive index go down, which would be a marker, at least for the renal side. I don't know what it does for the rest, but the renal side, that you'd be improving the actual perfusion.
Yeah, so, you know, I think the first thing is kind of, you know, after you've kind of done the best you can with the cardiac output and, you know, it may be too high, if sepsis is going to be too high and you're systemic vascular resistance is going to be too low, but you know that's the whole idea of the vasopressor is
yes.
kind of balance those things out. And so, you know, once I have a reasonable cardiac output and I have a reasonable SVR, I usually have a good map that I'm dealing with. And then, you know, I'll check the portal vein and I'll check my right atrial pressures. You know, look at the hepatic vein, the portal vein, and the kidney, and you can see. When you Doppler the inside of the kidney, you know, one of those intralobar arteries, you also get the vein. And so, you know, first of all, what Doppler signal below the baseline is going to tell you about something about what your right atrial pressures are and the backflow on your kidney. And as you know, that changes with how congested things are. And predicts mortality, I think. But the renal resistive index is the next thing I'm going to look at. And, you know, it is frequently high. And I don't really understand everything that's going on there, but I know that things I can do that actually make it better. And, you know, given that a high renal resistive index is associated with high mortality in sick patients, if I can correct that, hopefully I avert a kidney injury and therefore mortality. So some of the things we give, you know, like norepinephrine will constrict the afferent arterial, but it also induces the renal angiotensin aldosterone system, which will increase our angiotensin 2 levels. And the angiotensin 2 actually constricts the efferent and the afferent, and the efferent more constricts more than the afferent. So in the end, we win with our GFR there.
Okay.
The total blood flow through the kidney might go down, but there's a lot of things going on. I mean, there's shunting past the glomerulus. I don't know
right.
how that's affected by all this.
Right.
Usually the total blood flow in sepsis to the kidneys is actually high. It's not
elevated,
low.
Right. Yeah.
So, right. So in a way, if we do kind of bring the blood flow down, we actually are potentially bringing the, the circulation back towards normal in the kidney. Just like the cardiac output is too high, the renal blood flow might be too high, and maybe that's why it's shunting, because it's trying to protect the glomerulus or something.
Right, right, right. I remember a lecture by, I think it was Palomo, who had an interesting lecture on some nice EM microscopy of those shunts, and then some discussion of how this quote-unquote renal failure isn't necessarily renal failure. It's just the effect of some shunting like that. And really,
right,
the creatinine rise is somewhat irrelevant and, you know, of no clinical consequence, which is what we see most of the time. We see numbers that go up. You know, we worry it's going to go up so high we'll have to dialyze. Most of the time, it just comes back down. And we may think that it's because of things that we did, but it may or may not be.
Yeah, and oh, since you bring that up, it is kind of interesting that there's been studies done that, you know, are, you know, look for, you know, the patients that end up getting renal replacement therapy and all that, and the renal resistive index actually predicts it better than the creatinine, and actually is, you know, and part of the reason is there's a lot to creatinine too. I mean, it's not even going to go up until your GFR starts to drop below, like, say, 80 or something, because there's active proximal tubular excretion of the creatinine you know, and so forth. But anyway, basically, when I see a renal resistive index, I usually will start with norepinephrine, and a lot of times that actually does enough to make the renal resistive index drop a bit.
It usually
won't normalize it.
Just for those who are not used to you're using a cutoff of 0.7, and usually higher than 0.7 is abnormal, and below 0.7 is on the normalish range?
That's right. Yep. Exactly.
Okay.
Right. So I'll see it, you know, drop maybe a few points, 0.3, 0.4. You know, usually what my experience is I'll be starting with someone at, you know, 0.78 or even up to 0.8. The worse it is, depending on the studies you look at, it might actually indicate that this is a permanent kidney injury, not a transient one, or it could be an old kidney injury too. So there's a lot to that, but it will drop, and but sometimes it actually will go up. I've seen cases where I just had one this last week where I started with a kind of a bad renal resistive index and gave some norepinephrine. Blood pressure came up a little, but so did the renal resistive index. So if this is about kind of what's going on in the glomerulus and all that, the other thing is vasopressin, because vasopressin is only an efferent constrictor. So while it will probably, in theory, make the renal blood flow decrease a little bit because the total renal resistive forces will be higher, it drives that whatever
GFR
through the GFR. And in virtually every patient I've seen, I'm just kind of keeping, you know, a little log here on my own, and it's the exception, not the rule, for the renal resistive index to improve with the vasopress. I mean, you know, not improve with the vasopress.
Increase.
It just gets better. Yeah, right. And, you know, of course, there's some studies out there like the VANISH trial and all these sorts of things where they use vasopressin as the pressor, and there's kind of this signal there that the kidneys actually do better when vasopressin's in the mix, you know?
Yeah. Yeah. That's, it's a bit more importantly than numbers is the slight decrease in need for renal replacement therapy. Which is interesting stuff. Very interesting stuff. Yeah, I think we're really just, but I was a little bit concerned when I was reading that review paper when, you know, that graph came out with sort of a linear-ish relationship between blood pressure and perfusion, because, like, to me that's going to add even more confusion to people. I really don't think that's correct in the setting of sepsis when you're manipulating with vasopressors. And I think that needs to be sort of highlighted or, you know, explained away, something like that.
Yeah, right. Yeah. And again, that, you know, someone may need a different blood pressure than somebody else.
Of course. What the individualization of it is a whole different story. And, you know, there's some things that I like to do that I think we've discussed before, like coming out using tissue saturation and trying to find that sweet spot. But again, that's like Josh likes to call that the bleeding edge. There's no proof for it. It just seems to make some physiological sense. But this is all really, really interesting stuff. Like, I hope you keep collecting up that data on the vasopressin. And have you noted, for instance, if you're going, like, if you've got, you know, a renal Doppler of some kind or other, and you're choosing, let's say you decide this patient is fluid responsive and tolerant, and you've gone with fluids rather than pressure, this could be an interesting thing, maybe even in terms of just volume challenges, even, who knows, PLRs, you know, like, crank up my PLR, what happens to my renal resistive index? Do I improve or not? You know, is it those fluids just sort of sit in the unstressed volume and just add to the total fluid baggage, or is it contributing versus, I know I give a little shot of a push dose pressure and see what happens. I think it's pretty clear, any, you know, POCUS resuscitation is that, like, some of the stuff that we've been looking at recently, like you're overfilled, you've got pulsatile portal vein, you're really full, but don't even think of giving that person fluid. You know, the one with a virtual IVC and, you know, and an EF of 100%, of course give that one fluid before you crank with pressors. That makes no sense to give pressors. But we've got a whole big gray zone in the middle where I don't think anybody knows what to do. It'd be interesting to try to find a few more arrows to say, okay, at this point, maybe you go a little more with fluids, maybe you go a little more with vasopressin, something like that. Could be nice to see expand.
No, I completely agree. And, you know, if you would have, you know, caught me like 5 years ago, I would have been all about the PLR and just squeezing every little ounce of extra stroke volume with the fluid challenge that I could get. And I actually have kind of really moved away from that. I mean, you know, you got to kind of look at the whole situation going on there, and you know, your right atrial pressure might be low because your cardiac output is just, like, you know, just sucking the blood right through, and no big deal. Or they could be dry, you know, or they could have a hugely increased compliance or decreased squeeze on the venous storage system and all that that normally stressed volume is unstressed volume. So, you know, to me, it makes more sense, really. You know, if you sure give them a little fluids, but if you give just a vasopressor, that's going to squeeze down on those venous capacity.
Yeah, it's going to get some volume too, some effective volume.
And you're going to get the volume. And if they're volume responsive, well, there's your volume, you know. And, you know, we've been kind of traditionally taught, watch the IVC and keep resuscitating until, you know, it's not collapsing, you know, more than 50% or, you know, whatever.
The extermination of volume responsiveness is what I like to think of.
Right. But these are fat IVCs for what our IVCs are sitting at when we're healthy. You know, if we look at your IVC or my IVC, we would say, oh, give him, you know, some crystals, right? So, you know, I've kind of backed off. I'm happy with an IVC that's a little flat, as long as my SVR is good and my stroke volume is good. And I don't do, as many left ventricular outflow tract velocity time intervals anymore with a straight leg test. I just have kind of backed off and paid more attention to kind of the big picture. What's the LV up to? Are the lungs getting wet? What's the RV up to?
Yeah.
What's my right atrial pressure going up because I gave too much fluid? Is it that the pump's not dealing well with it anymore? You know, is there some pulmonary hypertension that's probably been there before, or is the sepsis inducing this? I don't know. So, you know, there's a lot of information you can gather, and you kind of have to be a good clinician and sort of put it all together into a picture about what's going on. You know.
Absolutely. I think hopefully we'll see the pendulum swing somewhat back, because, I mean, as you know, I've been, you know, a POCUS guy from the get-go. But in the beginning, it was a pre-POCUS area, and I was just trying to add to my clinical sort of picture. And then you kind of see how it's gone in the last few years, where it's kind of like POCUS is rejoining, you know, the same mistakes as, you know, the mainstream, let's say, has done before, where you're looking for, you know, threshold cutoffs of things of IVC sizes to fluid, no fluid. It's kind of like CVP, you know, CVP of, you know, your patient with low urine output in the 90s. If they had standing orders, if your CVP was more than 10, give LASIX, less than 10, give fluids. Like if they turned the sneeze, then they would got one or the other. It doesn't make much sense. And it's kind of gone. Right. POCUS has seen some trends of that in POCUS, which is sad, because using POCUS properly, you can get so much physiology, but you have to kind of go back to that original sort of artist at the bedside, where you have to piece all the things together. And sorry, there's not going to be a simple recipe that you can just say, here's what you give, you know.
Absolutely.
But I think you're absolutely right. You got to piece it all together.
Yeah, totally agree.
All right. Well, listen, I'm getting some pressure from the nurses around. You got to get back to work. But thanks so much for taking the time. That was really awesome. And we will talk soon.
Okay.
Ciao.
See you later.